Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here on a Sunday morning, grouping it up with Tiffany Ryder to discuss, among other things, her Substack and her latest views on the many healthcare issues. So with that, Tiffany, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Jay. It's great to be back here.
No, of course. I want to center a lot of the conversation around a lot of the recent writings that you've published, and also glean a little bit of your thoughts on where those writings are coming from. So before we jump into the actual specifics, can you talk a little bit about Signal and Noise and what that really means and what it has achieved so far?
Yes, it is a publication. I've never wanted to be a writer. There's lots of information out there, and I don't think we need more people contributing more noise. But what I found is that most health content that my patients were reading, that people I run into were reading, especially after the COVID pandemic and response, was either dumbed down to the point of just being useless, like something that really just isn't providing value to people, or it was so technical that it was really inaccessible. And yeah, one of the great things that's happened in the past couple of years since 2020 is that patients just don't believe anything. And I know that we look at the loss in public health as really a catastrophic issue, but I sort of see that there's an upside to that. And the upside is that patients are no longer just prostrate and waiting to be told what to do. They're actively involved in their care. They're actively seeking answers. And I see that as an opportunity. And so really, Signal and Noise is my attempt to separate signal from noise and help patients understand the different dynamics that go into making a clinical decision about their bodies or their kids' bodies, and giving, just providing context so that that patient can actually view the issue through a lens of informed consent and make decisions about how they want to proceed.
I like that.
Of course.
We have to put that plug in, of course.
Yeah, you do.
I like the way you framed that, because it segues into the article I want to talk about with Maha. Mm-hmm. But before I get to that, for those of you who are watching this who may not be familiar with your background, you were in the ER. You practice, you transition now into public policy, into public speaking, but you had that experience. So when you write an article about the storytelling problem with Maha, which we will have a link to in the comment section, that comes from a perspective, a direct experience in the trenches, and then from a broader perspective. So maybe give the context around that article, and then share a little bit about why you feel that's an important article to talk about, the storytelling problem.
Yes, thank you so much, because I do think it's one of the more dense articles that I've written. And, you know, I wasn't so sure that people were going to, you know, gravitate to that, because it is sort of involved. But, you know, I've been pleasantly surprised that people do want to talk about messaging and where information that they're getting comes from and how that works. And for me, some of the things I write are because I'm being asked those questions over and over and over again. And, you know, patients and policymakers and physicians are coming to me and they're saying, we really need the answers to these questions. But other things that I write are just things that need to be written. And that was this: the content and the messaging around Maha is something that nobody's really talking about. What's interesting, and I'll definitely get back to the, you know, the point of the clinical background and how I ended up here, but what's really interesting to me about Maha in this environment that is incredibly polarized, right? Politically polarized, culturally polarized, where we're being told that we have to pick a side, we have to pick a tribe. Maha doesn't really seem to fit in that box. When I speak to people on, you know, both sides of the political spectrum, everyone's sort of curious and excited about food policy and what's changing and what's going on. And there are some policy decisions that are being made, and we can get into some of those. but there's great policy that's actually happening. We are actually moving in a direction that is almost hard to believe, that because it's good and it's like actually has hope of having an impact on our chronic disease levels and on our children's health and all of these things. But there's so much just political divisiveness and garbage in the mainstream media that you don't really get to know any of that, or you don't get to understand why different moves are being made in the way that they're being made. And so anyway, that's the background behind that. And I did learn a lot of those lessons in the hospital during COVID. I think that the reason, like, it has been something that I can't not focus on, the COVID pandemic, right? Like, we all have to look back and, you know, I hear people say, why are you guys still talking about this? And it's because it changed everything about the way that we practice medicine, the way that we interpret this ecosystem that we live in. But a lot of the problem, from my perspective, with COVID was a lack of transparency. And, you know, everybody throws that term around, but it was really that we weren't speaking honestly about things that we knew and things that we didn't know. And as science changed and our understanding of what reality looked like changed, our institutions were hesitant, as institutions are, to admit, oh shoot, we were actually completely wrong about that. We were a little too sure of ourselves. Here's what the data actually looks like. And I think that's an institutional problem. It's not a left or right problem. It's a huge organization problem. We're trying to minimize chaos and, you know, how do we do that? But what it really did in COVID, where so many people were paying attention, so many people were scared, was it just created a situation where patients just say, I just don't believe any of this. I don't want anything to do with it.
No, I love that background, because you are now at the press room of the Health and Human Services. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important journey to map out when you talk about the storytelling issue, mm-hmm. and you talk about the good public policies that are there. As you speak, I'm parsing through the different aspects, and I want to maybe go step by step with each one, because I think that's very important. You talk about the public policy, and then you contextualize that with the public divisiveness. How much do you actually see that in the press room? Because we see that everywhere, right? The common person online, in the doctor's office, you see some of it. You kind of see the tension that you don't necessarily want to address, but when you see it, you kind of back away from. But do you see that in the press rooms?
I do, honestly.
That's amazing.
And, you know, one of the interesting things about being in the press room as a former, you know, emergency medicine clinician, I mean, I'm still licensed and it hasn't been that long, but it's just such a different background. And so, I mean, I want to tell you how it occurred to me that I needed to be in the room. We all lived through the first Trump presidency, and we all saw the headlines and the tweets and just information that it was hard to parse out, like, how is this happening? It was surprising. It was disruptive. It was chaotic at times, right? And so I had preconceived notions about different figures in the press, not just President Trump, but, you know, just different ideas in the press. And when the election was coming this past time, I said, you know, it's hard to really know, because I'd gone through this experience with COVID where I was like reading about what was happening in the hospital while working in the hospital and seeing that it was completely different than what was being reported in a lot of cases. And I said, wow, you know, the ability of media to spin things is kind of a big deal. I just want to like go to a few events and like see what's happening. And I had attended this event, and Trump was speaking there, and I heard everything he had to say, and I said, huh, that's really interesting. There's like nothing like off the wall, like nothing super unpredictable that happened here. I guess there just won't be a story on this tomorrow. And I went home and like that was sort of my thought. And I woke up the next morning and the story was, I'm not even going to get into it, but the story was something insane, right? And I was in the room. I had heard everything that was said. I had heard the entire context of the question that was asked and the answer that was, well, you know, it's just when you make decisions in this way, it's really hard to see it from this perspective. And here's the example and here's how it goes. And it was a completely reasonable statement at face value. And that reasonable statement was then taken into the media and was this whole other sort of crazy off the wall story was created. And that was really the eye-opening moment where I thought, okay, like, I don't know what's true and what's not true in all of these other contexts, like, fine. But I was literally right there. And when that statement was made about the way you make decisions and the way it feels to make a decision sitting in a comfy chair in DC versus feeling to make a decision when you're out on the battlefield or whatever, like, those things are different. Well, of course they are. Yes, I get it. Anyway, and to see something like that turn into a totally different narrative that had nothing to do with what had occurred in that room was just like, wow, okay, well, how many other times is this happening? Like, what's happening? And so that was my initial, you know, thought of, well, the thing that I care about more than anything is what's going on in health policy, because that is my, you know, area where I think we can make huge life-changing differences for normal everyday people who are just trying to live their lives and not be health policy experts. And I wanted to be in the room. So back to your question about divisiveness in the press room, it's interesting to sit and hear experts talk about an issue, hear Marty McCary, the commissioner at the FDA, talk about an issue, right? You hear usually these press events, you hear from, you know, 5 or 10 people. There's a patient there who's talking about their experience. There's policy writers who were, you know, actually in the thick of things explaining their side. And you hear all of these perspectives, and it's just a different experience for me as a clinician, because as I'm hearing Marty McCary talk about the, you know, initiative, the evidence that came out that made us put a black box warning on estrogen, right? And as I'm hearing him talk about the confidence interval, which, you know, for everyone, it's just like the strength of the evidence of how likely it was that it resulted in this
statistical significance. Yeah. Yes.
Like, how statistically significant is it? Did it just happen by chance? What's the deal? So anyway, I'm listening to this and my mind just processes that different as a clinician than someone from the Wall Street Journal who's basically sitting there with their phone and just waiting to hear their whatever divisive, you know, question their editor has sent them on their phone. And so I think that's been a huge difference because, you know, the questions I'm able to ask, like, there are still legitimate questions that need to be asked. I don't always agree with every framing, or I don't always understand every aspect of different policies that are happening. But I feel like I'm able to ask more clinically relevant questions because I thought, well, I've had a lot of patients that I've treated in the emergency room with kidney infections that come from bladder infections that can be exacerbated by an estrogen deficiency in the vaginal area, right? So, like, why have I never prescribed vaginal estrogen to a patient alongside antibiotic? Why have I never done that? Like, I've literally never done that. I should have done that. And so I do think that having a clinical background in the press room is, like, helpful. And I do think that it allows me to ask questions that aren't unbiased, right? Because who of us are unbiased? But I'm biased towards my experience of having treated patients as opposed to how can I, you know, make this policy look good or bad so that it appeals to whoever's paying my bills at my newspaper. And I think that's valuable.
You know, let's maybe parse that piece by piece, because I think that's really important. And we'll get to the estrogen issue, because I know that recently made headlines and we should probably discuss that. But I want to maybe take that in two steps. One sure. is talking about the anatomy of a spin. So a publication comes out, a policy mandate is made, and then it's presented in the press room. Then it goes out to the media. At what point do you start to see the bias creep in? Is it within that room? Is it as soon as people leave the room? Because at the end of the day, these are people interacting. You're interacting with your colleagues. You're interacting in the press room. Obviously, there must be some exchange going on in terms of overt communication. So is it like you guys are sitting in the same room and just like diametrically opposing everything that comes, left is right, so on and so forth? Or does the spin take place at a later time?
Oh, no. I think people walk into the room with preconceived notions most of the time, right? And you know, you never really quite know unless you have sources on the inside. Like, we have an idea of sort of what's going to be announced, but you don't know the details of how it's going to come out. But you can hear the chatter, you know, just sitting in your seat of people saying, oh, well, you know, this is what I think is going to be announced, and here's why it's garbage, right? Like, people really do have their own ideas. That said, the coverage of these health agencies has not been completely biased in one direction. I think it is mostly, but it's not always. And I do think, you know, that part of my bias is that I actually knew and followed the work of the agency leaders for years. Like, I've been following Marty McCary and Jay Bhattacharya for, I don't know, the last 5 years, 8 years, whatever it is. And so, you know, I have a bias too, in that when I walk in that room, I think, okay, I may or may not agree with whatever the outcome is, or whatever the way they're trying to get to this, you know, wherever they're trying to get is, although often I do, but I already walk in with the idea of these men are trying to do the right thing, and they are smart, and I have read their work. I am familiar with, you know, where they're coming from and what their journey has been, because I've watched it and participated in real time. And I think that that allows me to sit and be open-minded and say, okay, these things are being done. Nothing nefarious is going on. So let me try to understand exactly what they're saying. And that's been nice. It's a nice way to interpret and receive information.
And having that personal relationship with folks like Jay Bhattacharya, who've really seen the worst of it in the COVID period, and then to see them in the forefront enacting policy that's truly patient-centric, has to feel like a full circle moment. So I mean, just good for you on that standpoint. Yes. Let's talk a little bit about the issue of estrogen and what data does to decision-making. Can you give a little bit of context around the quality of the data that was initially used to make certain labels or certain stigmas, if you will, on the use of topical estrogen, and how we're now starting to come to fruition to say, hey, this may not be the kind of data that we really want to make decisions on?
Yeah, so, and it's interesting because one of the big problems that I have with the way that messaging comes out in the health field is exactly what I just started with, right? Like, it's either so dumbed down or it's so complicated. And really, most people just need something in the middle. And one of the things that I think we've done an incredibly bad job of is teaching people how to look at a study and without, you know, getting a master's degree in biostatistics, able to understand basic ideas about data. I did well in statistics. I'm not an epidemiologist, but I don't believe that you should have to be an epidemiologist to look at a study and say, this one looks like it actually like really matters, or this one looks like it had like a ton of like bias, and this one, you know, looked at six kids, and then we took that data and just applied it to, you know, the 75 million kids that we have in this country. Like, there are some basic things, and one of those things is called a confidence interval. We don't talk about these things. We haven't taken statistics. You probably don't think about confidence intervals ever. But, you know, there are discrete ranges of numbers that when we crunch the numbers and do the math, we know that if the confidence interval is one thing, then that means we can't really say that it's likely that something, that thing A caused thing B. And we should just be honest and say, well, we don't really know.
Like, yeah, exactly.
We don't know what happens. And that's actually what happened with the estrogen. You know, there's a whole story. Marty McCary writes a chapter about it in his book, Blind Spots, where he goes through the backstory. He went and interviewed the researchers and the people who were involved before he became the FDA commissioner. But suffice to say that the statistical probability that estrogen was causing breast cancer was not robust. It certainly wasn't robust enough to say that it did. And the press was involved. There was a public messaging thing that was involved. Women are inherently, rightfully so, very anxious and concerned about the possibility of this scary disease that we all hear about, and we know people and love people who suffer from it and die from it. And so once that narrative came out that this is what hormone replacement therapy does, then it became impossible to do it. And, you know, it's not just that an institution puts a black box warning and says this is super scary, which is already bad enough if the evidence doesn't actually support that. Mm-hmm. But the idea that you now have women who go to their doctor, and if their doctor tries to explain to them, and I know some of these doctors who are like, well, I just continued prescribing because I looked at the evidence and it was garbage and who cares, right? I know some of these very smart physicians, very brave, who just said, well, this is what we're going to do. But it doesn't matter when you have a woman who's been reading about it in the press and all of her friends are saying this, and this is the general consensus, is that HRT causes these big scary things, then I'm not going to explore HRT. And it's not that hormone replacement therapy for women is safe for every woman, right? Like, if there are, there are women who have family history of things, who have personal medical histories of certain conditions or things that make it a really bad idea. But that isn't what was propagated. That wasn't the message. And so one of the earlier policy changes that did happen was the FDA came in and said, well, actually, we know this research is garbage. We know this confidence interval didn't really say anything. So let's stop fear-mongering women and make HRT available. And let's institutionally say, we screwed up for 20 years and we told you the wrong thing. And that was bad. And women have suffered because of that. And so anyway.
No, that was a big deal. That was on the cover of Time magazine back in the 90s when people were reading Time magazine in droves. And it was incredible. I still remember that article. I still remember that cover story. It's fascinating to see how much of what we assume comes from data that is truly not robust. And it's difficult to explain, because I agree that there is this issue where you talk about, you know, policy, you talk about the complexity of the data and how at a certain point you have to make decisions on the data, but it could be done in a much more open and transparent manner. Let's maybe transition on a positive note, because I think that there are a lot of positive developments to discuss. Let's maybe highlight one or two real positive developments, like combating processing foods, you know, combating rapid data results for certain rapid drug developments. talk a little bit about how you saw those positive developments first appear through HHS and then how it kind of then disseminated over the media and how you saw the storylines take place?
Yeah, so this is something I'm still sort of spun up about, and I hate, you're trying to move us in a positive direction, and I'm like, yes, but here's something I want to complain about.
Yeah.
But, you know, from a policy perspective, I have never seen so much positive movement, so much movement in the direction of giving patients more access, more transparency, changing things so that clinicians can actually serve their patients, maybe ever, right? Like, there have been so many positive developments. The HRT discussion that we just went through, right? The removal of that black box to make it more consistent with the data, the food policy, the whole dietary guidelines, food pyramid changes. All of these things are huge. I grew up, I know we talked about this last time, but you know, I grew up in a community where a lot of us were poor. I got my two meals a day from school. Those were my cooked meals that I got a day, and they were on the free lunch program. So, you know, some of these policies, it's like, it's not just saying, oh, eat real food. Like, it's actually saying, as, you know, a government institution, we are saying that eating real food matters and will change health outcomes. And once that is set in policy, it affects what all of these children are receiving in free lunch, what our military is receiving at the DFAC, at their cafeteria, right? What is available through food stamps and, you know, other government programs. And so it actually has a huge impact and has the ability to move the needle. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, for my negative framing, my complaint, like, I don't see that information always coming out and being disseminated. So that is still a problem, because if I'm doing good things from the policy side, but nobody knows about it, then it sort of slows that momentum.
What do you think is going to transpire in 2026? Because a lot of positive developments, even media outlets that have clear bias against, whether it's RFK mm-hmm. Jr. at a personal level mm-hmm. or just the MAHA movement in less than medical or less than scientific ways, it's hard to deny a lot of the common sense positive policy that are coming out. What do you think is going to come about in 2026?
I mean, I think we are going to continue to push forward on the policy side, and I hope that the reframing and the messaging around what we're doing starts to gain more traction. So, like mm-hmm. something that I talked about in the article that you referenced and that I've talked about a lot this week is, you know, things like the removal of petroleum-based dyes from foods, right? This is something that we've all sort of agreed is a good idea. We would like to do that. And one of the main news stories in the health policy world over the last couple of weeks has been, well, Kennedy has shifted from a ban of artificial dyes to, you know, a handshake deal with the food companies. And these are from what you would expect to be MAHA friendly voices mm-hmm. who are disappointed. And, you know, when you look into the health policy of it, and I think that the American public is so smart, like, we don't want to quit our job and become health policy experts, but like, if you just give people context, they get it.
Right.
And one of the things that I don't hear being said in the media is that, like, yes, we can ban the things, okay? But, like, it's institutionally, by law, a super slow process, right? There's the regulations that that govern this, the FFDCA, you know, they require a public commenting period. They require legal review. They require, you know, certain forms of scientific evidence, blah, blah, blah. So, like, the whole thing is meant to be slow. So, actually, the fastest way to do this is to talk to Big Food, talk to industry, tell them, hey, this is something that, like, everybody agrees on, like, Can we come together? Can you commit to do this while we're going through this other process? And then you're positioned as the, you know, the healthier alternative to, I don't know, cereal. So it is real progress. But if no one's saying that to the public, then, you know, maybe a mom of a child who has ADHD who's particularly sensitive to, I don't know, red food dye is saying, oh, well, these people told me they were going to take care of me. They said they were going to, you know, get this out of the food system. And now they're making deals with Target. Why are they doing that? And so what I'm hoping will happen is that, you know, as this has gone along, I'm hoping that our policymakers will realize that you can't just make good policy. You can't just do the right thing. You have to do the right thing. And you have to make sure that the narrative is simple enough and punchy enough and comes out before whatever the garbage is, right? Because if the New York Times has already told me that Kennedy is like making handshake deals with Big Food and they're no longer banning my red dye 40 and that's why I voted for this administration, I'm already angry. I'm already not open to hearing what you have to say. But if I hear that before that narrative is seeded, then all of a sudden it becomes easier to understand. So I'm hoping that now that everyone's sort of gotten settled in and the policy machine is moving, that they'll shift focus a little to these these communication issues, because we're sick of it. The public is very sensitive to being messed with after the COVID debacle, and we're like, look, we want transparency, and we want to hear about it before. We want you to come and tell us what's happening before we're asking more questions. And so I'm hoping that we'll start to see the obvious questions being answered before people are confused and searching from the New York Times and other outlets.
Let me conclude by asking a hopelessly simplistic question, but I think that it's really, it would be a lot of interest to the people who are watching this. You're in the press room, you're a clinician, you have experience from top to bottom, inside and outside, macro, micro. You have a working relationship with a lot of these top figures. What are you whispering in their ears to help them along the lines that you had mentioned? Are you giving them feedback? Are you mentioning, hey, this is what I'm noticing, or hey, this is maybe how you want to phrase it? How much of an input do you have from your vantage point?
And I would say that my number one platform of how I'm doing that, whether it's, you know, behind closed doors or in public, is I'm saying the same things on signalandnoise.online as I'm saying in other venues. I mean, that has been my biggest push, is not in the policy, it's in the communications. And it's so funny because one of my best friends is a health policy expert with 2 decades of experience in DC at the highest levels. And like, we get on the phone and I'm like, whoa, why didn't I know what the answers to how is Jay Bhattacharya going to run 2 agencies 600 miles apart? And, you know, and she's like, yeah, but why policy something, right? So I do think that there's like this this interesting interplay of these wonderful, brilliant, they all happen to be men, but these wonderful, brilliant men are looking at what needs to change. How do we change the incentive structures? How do we, you know, like, get more people to be willing to replicate these, you know, landmark studies? Like, how do we do this and, like, make it work? And they get all excited about the change that they can really make, because these policies are just system changing. And I guess I just see myself as like this little tiny voice that whenever I have the chance to be like, hey, 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 but also make sure you don't forget to tell everybody about it. Make sure you don't forget to frame the narrative, because I don't believe in, you know, propaganda and just making stuff up. But I do very much believe, like, if there is truth and there is good being done, like, toot your own horn and explain to me, like, why this is the right thing. Because maybe we don't know about a public commenting period that Department of Labor, you know, has to go through. Like, well, just tell me that, and then I understand. And so, you know, if I have any role, it's definitely there. And there is nothing that that I would not just write on my Substack that I would say in private.
That's awesome. So for those of you who are listening, the Substack name is Signal and Noise Tiffany Ryder. So Tiffany, as always, thank you so much. It's always great to talk to you.
This was so fun. Thanks so much for having me on.
Take care.